Welcome to Zero Downtime, the new podcast brought to you by DCD's editorial team in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical infrastructure provider.
Vertiv has kept the world's leading businesses connected for more than 50 years. We build, deliver, and support critical infrastructure that's available, sustainable, and future-ready. Visit us at Vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Hello, welcome to DCD Downtime. This week, I'm talking about green software with Anne Curry. The reason I'm talking with Anne is she is the co-author of a book coming from O'Reilly about green software. And have there been books on this subject before? What's the idea of this one?
Yes, there have. It's one of the things that, oddly enough, middle of last year, O'Reilly asked me to go through all their books on green software to say, so that they could put together a reading list. And there are some very good books out there. The trouble is a lot of them are quite old. They hadn't produced one for at least 5 years, more like close to 10 years, a generic one. And although they were good, things have changed in the meantime. And also a lot of what they had was quite specific. We kind of wanted to step back and give a high level, what is it we're attempting to do here? How does green software fit in with the tech industry?
Mm-hmm. So yes, let me ask that as a question then. How does green software fit in with the tech industry? Why should we be doing it? How should we be doing it? What does it mean?
Well, I mean, we are an industry. All industries are going to have to start adjusting to the energy transition. And the energy transition is the move away from fossil fuels, which are on demand, cheap, highly commoditized. We've managed to make using oil, gas, coal as efficient as it's possible to be. But we're moving on to something new. And in the long term, wind and solar, I think, are going to be super cheap and they're going to be great. But we're not there yet. They're not available at a huge scale yet. And they are very tight, unlike oil and gas, and there's a reason why fossil fuels have been the bedrock of society up until now. They are incredibly good at what they do. They're really highly energy efficient, and they're a great storage mechanism for energy. Mm-hmm. And they're available at the flick of a switch. Whenever you want it, it's available. And that isn't the case for wind or solar. And that doesn't mean that isn't like, I'm not doing the whole thing of, they're not as good, therefore we shouldn't even try and move to them. We have to move to them. So we have to find some way of working with those great potential, but also great issue sources of energy. And you can say, oh, just use batteries, but batteries are very energy undense. They're nothing like a can full of petrol. So there are problems that we're going to have to solve. And according to the EU, there are two big areas of change that the tech industry will have to get involved in. One is energy use in data centers. The other is embodied carbon in devices. How do we make devices last longer?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And when you put it like that, both of those sound like hardware problems, not software problems. In the data center industry, we have spent 20 years sort of trying to switch off air conditioning units, trying to make sure that as much of the energy that goes into the data center goes to the servers, on the assumption that everything they do is good. And and that the best way to stop waste is to just get energy to the servers as quickly as possible. I mean, energy efficiency in data centers looks like a hardware problem, but it isn't really, is it?
It isn't. No, it isn't really a hardware problem. You're quite right that over the years we've been incredibly good in the data center industry at becoming efficient at using hardware. It's the EU were quite right when they said that the issue with hardware in to do with the tech industry is not about what goes on in data centers usually, because we are pretty good at managing hardware data centers. It's what goes on in homes. It's users. And a lot of that isn't a hardware problem. For the steps that we have left to take in data centers are software related, and a lot of the steps that we have to take in people's homes are software related as well. So, for example, in homes, when was the last time? And I know we talk on endlessly about right to repair and all that kind of stuff, and it's great. I have no problem with right to repair on phones. That's fantastic. It's absolutely a no-brainer. We should definitely do it. But my devices have to be thrown away always because they run out of security patches. That's the end of life for all my devices. And that's a software problem, not a hardware problem. Or I want to use some new application, but I'm going to need to, it's not backwardly compatible with my phone. Well, for me, it's always security patches, but that's because I'm a bit old school. But for a lot of people, it's wanting the new access to new apps and things like that. So that is a software problem. We need to make sure that things are backwardly compatible and we aren't throwing away working hardware because of going out of security patches. That just cannot be the main failure mode of software, of hardware, of end user devices in future. But on the other side, in data centers, I mean, yeah, we all know it's that the win that the cloud is bringing over traditional data centers is the use of software to get much, much higher server density and within data centers. And the EU are shouting about this as well with the SDIA initiative, the sustainable
data center, digital infrastructure.
Digital infrastructure agency. I can never remember what it stands for.
Oh, damn it. hope Max Schultz doesn't hear you say that.
But you know, I'm talking about the SDIA, and it is so we can't complain that much. But their push is that the non-clouds need to start adopting some of the same technology that the clouds do, mm-hmm. kind of using Kubernetes, open source tools to get multi-tenancy. That high server density, high machine utilization, and it's all software.
Yeah, that's true. You can make a data center as efficient as you like, but if you've got some software that makes one data center do the job of two, that's one whole data center you haven't got.
Absolutely.
So, yeah. So, tell us about the book. You're going to that tells us how to do this, does it?
Well,
or possibly not exactly.
I wish that it did. In many ways, the book is about telling you what not to do, based mm-hmm. on the fact that all three authors go out and speak a lot about this, and we listen to the questions we get, and a lot of the questions are, should I do this? And the answer is no, you shouldn't. It's good in theory, but actually in practice, it's not a very scalable way of solving the problem. Yes.
It depends. I mean, I've been sort of skimming through the chapters that are available through O'Reilly already, and just stopped at one bit where it said about, you know, maybe you've got some code that you could make much, much more efficient. But if it's something that only half a dozen people use and they only use a couple of times a week, the win, the amount of, you know, kilojoules you'll save that way is very, very small.
Yes, it is amazing. So the book came out of, so I'm involved in the Green Software Foundation, which is kind of just trying to raise the profile in the industry for being green, thinking about this kind of stuff. And it is very software focused. It's Green Software Foundation. And Sarah and Sarah are my contributors,
you nearly said conspirators, didn't
you? Co-conspirators. They are definitely my co-conspirators in the Green Software Foundation. And we're very keen on because actually, you know, the hardware industry has done amazing stuff. Operational engineers and hardware and data center engineers have really been doing all the heavy lifting up until now. Well, software engineers have all been, la, 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 that's their problem. And it's not. It's our problem now. We have an enormous ability to contribute to this. But one of the things that we talk in conferences all the time, one of the things that comes up every time we speak, someone gets up at the end and say, well, there are two things that come up. But what the first one that comes up is, should I just be rewriting my applications in C? And, you know, it's hard to say no, because if you rewrite your applications in C, you might well get 100-fold improvement in efficiency, but it will kill your business. I mean, I used to do that in the old days. I used to write big servers in C on networking and things where it was really, where performance was really critical. And also this was in the 90s when all the machines were, you know, terrible. Absolutely terrible. 1,000 times worse than they are today. And so you had to tune everything like crazy.
Or it wouldn't work at all.
The internet was terrible. The machines were terrible. Everything was terrible. I mean, it was great. It was 0-1, wasn't it? It was, you know, we hadn't had anything. And then we had something.
It was more about the good old days.
But it was 1,000. Everything was 1,000 times worse than it is today. But in the software industry, we have used that 1,000-fold increase in the quality of machines to not deliver machine utilization, better machine productivity. We've used it to deliver developer productivity. So now we write in much easier to use languages, and we go much faster, and we do things in quite inefficient ways compared to how we did. But
just because you need to get it out the door before your competitors do.
Absolutely. Yes. Which you have to. You've got no choice. You have to do that. Plus, we just don't have the skills. We don't have the number of engineers to do. We couldn't, you know, if we were writing everything in C, it wouldn't touch the sides in terms of replacing what we have now. It takes ages to write everything in C or Rust or, you know, even Go or something like that. It's slow. So you have to use it where it matters. Where it matters is things that are going to be used by loads and loads and loads of people, because it takes ages to do this stuff. It'll kill most businesses, would be killed by attempting to do this. Mm-hmm. And I don't want everybody's business to be killed, although it's all render use.
I suppose things that are used by, it doesn't even have to be used by very many people. It has to be used by very, very many times by maybe automated processes, to go right down to the basis of the things that get done, that are just working over and over and over underneath things.
Absolutely, yes. So I think for most people in enterprises, this is really about managing your supply chain, and it's about putting pressure on suppliers so every platform that you're running on needs to be green. You know, they need to actively be green. They need to actively care and be doing this and be having pressure put on them by other customers as well. So it's not so much about your code, it's about your platform. And that won't be, you know, maybe that's, because what you want is you want your platform to have invested in all these efficiency changes. Has your platform rewritten itself in Rust? Has it even measured? Has it checked? Has it made itself as efficient as possible? Because that's much, much, much more effective than you doing it just for your own stuff.
Right. Yes. Yes. You're not going to design a better car. You just have to buy a better car.
Absolutely.
The tools are there, and you pick the best one and buy. In some ways, kind of actions speak louder than code. You should be choosing the right tools.
Yes, absolutely. Unless you're somebody in the audience who is working for a hyperscaler or more subtly here, an open source tool or a language that is widely used. So I was hearing the other day, and I haven't confirmed this, so I don't want to be defaming anybody, but things like the standard libraries that come along with some of the very common popular languages. So, for example, Go. Are those standard libraries optimized? Are they green? Because those standard libraries are used all the time. It's really well worth tuning those, or get the people who are actually writing those languages tuning those libraries rather than you tuning your code that runs on top of those libraries.
Mm-hmm.
And if those libraries aren't tuned, then everything that you're doing is terrible. But you can't do anything about it. Libraries need to be tuned, but you need to be putting pressure on and saying, are they?
Right. And it's not 100% clear, you know, who's doing them and where and why and how they're paid and how they're incentivized to make it more efficient. Yeah, that goes well beyond your applications or even your platforms, because, you know, these tools are common across Azure, AWS and other cloud platforms. It's like, yes, absolutely. This means we should probably talk about the origins and the potential power of the Green Software Foundation. I mean, how's it come about, and how is it going to change the world?
Well, Emily, it came about very informally. I didn't form it. It was formed by the I just got involved very fast. It was formed by the current chair, a chap called Asim Hussain, who used to work at Microsoft at the time. He was at the time that it was formed. He was the cloud advocate at Microsoft, and yes, I mean, how did he? I think it was kind of a very low stakes startup with him. Mm. Well, actually, I believe he'd been doing some work with Accenture, and Accenture got very keen on it, and they went and talked to Bill Gates, and he said thumbs up. So they set it up as a Linux Foundation, and the idea was always to kind of to answer the question that you posed at the start, which is, is this a software problem or is it a hardware problem? And the answer is it's both. But at the moment, hardware data centers are addressing this, and the software industry really wasn't. And they weren't addressing it because they had nothing useful to do. They were not addressing it because it just wasn't something that was occurring to them. So we just need to kind of get people demanding it. Get people asking for it from their open source projects, and a lot of the focus of the Green Software Foundation has been about measurement. And a lot of the reason why we're focusing on measurement is because you can measure, and then you can put pressure on your providers and your suppliers. When someone raised to me the other day about standard libraries not being efficient, I thought, gosh, nobody talks about this, but it is incredibly important. It's never the decision that you never choose a language based on whether the standard libraries are efficient or not, but you really need to be.
Mm-hmm. Yes. And if I suppose you might imagine something where you choose a library that you can use because you understand it, and then something else translates it into a library that's actually efficient.
Hmm.
But yeah, so I mean, the Green Software Foundation, I mean, the you seemed a very kind of friendly, somewhat loose association. And when you meet people in the Green Software Foundation, you're not sort of immediately hit over the head by who they are and who they're working for. It's almost like this is your side hustle, your hobby. It's something you're sort of wanting to make happen. And that's almost like a kind of, it fits with the fact that when you make a data center more efficient, there are visible ways in which it is more efficient, and there are visible ways in which authorities can enforce that it becomes more efficient. I mean, how does the Green Software Foundation make this something that gets mandated or enforced or something, or is that not at all the way in which it can happen?
Well, I would love it if it was enforced or mandated. But at the moment, that isn't our focus. We aren't. We did talk about whether we should be a lobbying group, you know, lobbying governments to put rules in place. But it's not really our skill set. So it isn't our focus at the moment. At the moment, we are completely focused on just pushing people to be aware of it, to measure, rather than getting the law involved. But as you say, in the hardware industry, in data centers, the law has been very effective. And we aren't doing that, but maybe we should.
Yes. I mean, I guess part of the problem is having something that's agreed on as a measure of what is efficient and what isn't. That being a really difficult thing because it's a multi-dimensional problem in ways which I don't quite understand. But what's the progress towards having measures of the efficiency of code?
Well, there's the SCI, the Software Carbon Intensity measurement rules that are being worked on. Now, they're not in the area that I work on, so I understand they're all going very well, but I don't know that much about it. It is kind of just here's broadly how you should be measuring. You know, you need to be taking into account how many operations and users and that kind of stuff. So
it's sort of working towards how many watts per unit of work or something, or
it is in the same way that watts per byte is a key measurement criteria in the networking industry, but it isn't in the software industry. Watts per it's because in the networking it's quite interesting, watts per bit or watts per byte is quite clear what that means, but what is a unit of work in this when it comes to software, you know, it's harder to net that down. I think the SCI is trying to move us in that direction, but I don't think it's ever going to be quite as clear cut.
Yes. And it does seem like there are sort of, you know, parallel approaches where, you know, instead of making code more efficient, you could make it more aware, so it always moves to the lowest carbon power source.
Yes, I have to say I'm a huge fan. We talked at the beginning about variable solar energy availability and variable wind energy availability. One of the things that Google have been working on this for years, and they are very good. They don't talk about it much, but they have done some really interesting stuff on reducing the energy use of and the efficiency of their data centers. And they're really, really looking at time shifting. So not necessarily moving from one location to another, but if you can move a job forward in time, if you can delay a job until there's more solar or wind available, especially, you know, if you can delay for 12 hours, fantastic. Now, and sometimes they can. There are jobs that really aren't all that time sensitive. Things like machine learning. It's not necessarily training rather than querying. It's not that time sensitive. They can at least, you know, stick a couple of hours in there and move to when the wind's blowing or when the weather forecast says the sun's about to come out. All that kind of stuff. It's necessary. It is going to be necessary. And then that will put the ball back in the court of data centers to handle the issue of the embodied carbon in those machines, because if they're not being used all the time, then they need to last longer. So it's kind of, it's, you know, if we solve our problem, it's going to give you guys a problem.
Yes, I was just thinking, if you delay your processing till the carbon intensity goes down, that means having an idle processor, which it might be lost revenue, or it might be, it mean to get the same amount of processing done, you'd have to have more processors available, therefore more embodied carbon. So exactly those two things kind of potentially in the negative column on doing that.
Yeah, I mean, it's not a no-brainer. The delaying stuff is not a no-brainer. It means that we're going to have to balance those things. As you say, do you need more machines? Or maybe you use software to know, so that you need fewer machines, but then you use all the gain by adding in time shifting. It's a complicated problem.
What's the biggest, easiest, quickest wins to sort of start doing things on green software now? I mean, there's an obvious one, which is getting which I'm sure you were about to say.
I would say the biggest win is always do less. You know, that is turn off stuff that isn't being used. Do less. Mm-hmm. Be lean. It's all that kind of lean. That don't do things that just in case. Turn off, but really just turn off stuff that you're not using anymore. Turn off stuff while it's not being used. Turn off test kit overnight. Developer machines overnight. Just are you storing more data than you need to just in case? You know, get rid of it all, or at least move it into long-term storage like tape, which is quite, if it comparatively, very efficient.
Oh, I hope just that last half a minute is making some listeners go, whoops.
Yeah, it's always do less is the first thing. But then after that, it's all the clever stuff to do with after that, down the road, it'll all be multi-tenancy and time shifting, really.
Right. And somewhere along in parallel with that, just making the basic code efficient, but focusing the effort on the code that gets used most.
Absolutely, yeah. But yeah, as you say, this is a buy, not build problem.
Mm-hmm. Gosh, well, you've actually just made it all sound quite simple. I don't know if it feels that way.
It's my job to make it sound simple.
I think it's someone's job to go out and discover what the real problem is.
Oh yeah, no, it's a really, really tricky problem to solve. This, you know, the energy transition is a massively difficult problem for the whole of humanity. Ooh. And it's the thing is, I like most of us, we're in tech because we like difficult problems. This is a really tricky problem, but it's really impactful. You know, this is the thinking we do here. One of the reasons why we could have left the tech industry to kind of be the last to start thinking about this, because we're not a massively polluting industry. We, you know, it depends how you count things, but you know, we're not agriculture. We don't have as much to do. We're not as big a part of the problem.
Yes, but, we don't use a lot of nitrogen.
No, exactly. Indeed, yeah, we don't use a lot. We don't produce huge quantities of methane. Even worse, but we are very good at doing stuff. If we can come up with clever ways of managing this, we can maybe roll that out to everybody else and actually do something really good. I mean, the tech industry does really good things. We produce amazing tools. We've completely revolutionized the world, and it's been fantastic. But it's very interesting how lots of folk don't go. That one of the issues with there aren't many women in the tech industry, and one of the reasons is that the tech industry is not seen as being an industry that does good, that benefits humankind. People would rather go into medicine or something like that, where you see kind of clear benefits to humankind. But I would say that's completely wrong. The tech industry benefits humankind enormously. And we can do even more if we start thinking about this, coming up with solutions, helping. I mean, I would strongly recommend reading the Bill Gates book on the climate change, the climate emergency. It's very good indeed. Green folk don't love it. I have to say, green folk really don't love it because they hate a tech utopian solution. But I love a tech utopian solution, so I'm like, we need to get involved and build things that will mean that we can both. Everything that we're doing at the moment is about marrying up how we transition to the new energy sources without totally going back to the Stone Age. And I think that we can do that. We can have them both. We can have a great future and also green the tech, green the industry, green humanity, make it so that we don't overheat the planet. We can do both, but we have to realize we can't be constantly, if we put ourselves up against human progress and better quality of life and all that kind of stuff, we'll lose because people won't want to do it. We have to say, we have to find ways to do both. Yes. And I think we as a tech industry have a huge role to play in that.
Mm. Yes, because very often some of the response to this is we don't really have to do this because we don't use much energy. We're being very efficient already. And, you know, quite a lot of the stuff that happens in data centers is saving energy elsewhere. I mean, nobody's ever managed to put a figure on that or to say, you know, how much, you know. So, I did speak to one guy who was trying to do that. And it wasn't 100% convincing. And in any case, even if you are doing good, that's really not the reason for not doing better. If you can, and if doing so will help inspire other people in other sectors to make their steps.
Yeah, because there's no good enough here, really. We're going to have to do amazingly well. And it's, you know, it's to those with the widest shoulders, you know, the greatest burden. We're full of clever people. We have money in the tech industry. We're a powerful industry. We need to get involved.
Yes. So on one level, yeah, that means we're the industry that can afford to buy renewable energy when it's more expensive and bring the price down. We're an industry that can have sort of bizarre little punts and saying let's punt something on fusion energy being around much sooner than anybody thinks. Or, you know, we can afford to do all sorts of things like that.
I'm gonna say my normal cup of tea bet here, now that you've mentioned fusion, because I keep saying this all the time, and eventually I'm going to get a load of cups of tea, I think. I think there will be space-based solar power on a national grid before there is fusion-generated power on a. Now, that's a very controversial thing. Everybody thinks I'm crazy when I say, I've been saying that for years, everybody thinks I'm crazy, but I'm not crazy and it will happen.
Right. Yes, I mean, I'm interested in that for at least a couple of reasons. One is that I did spot a press release recently from an American university that has just put up the first satellite attempting to demonstrate it's possible. And another, there was that lovely film Moon sending that space-based energy, which was a little bit dystopian in parts. But... So space... Right. Space-based solar energy. And no doubt, when it emerges, a lot of it will turn out to be a software problem, won't it?
Oh, yes. Yeah. Software engineers have had it too easy. I mean, you might feel that in the data center industry, everybody's been trying really hard and working really hard on this for years. And that is true. It is unfortunate that I'm now giving you a kicking when, in fact, it's the software industry. But it's Green Software Foundation. It's about software. But you are going to have to do a lot more too. It's unfortunate.
Absolutely. Right. So, well, anyway, but it's going to be involved both software and hardware. It's all, these things are always both and. And when does the book come out? I think we need to finish on that. When can we get hold of physical copies? When can we get hold of soft copies? And, to tell us more about that.
So the book is being published as we write it in very rough form on the O'Reilly, on the Safari website, the O'Reilly's online publishing platform. And three chapters are already on that. The idea is that the physical book will come out once all the chapters have been written and submitted, which hopefully by the end of the year, so hopefully early next year. They're currently saying on the site, they're saying July 2024, but I'm really hoping for sooner than that, I have to say. So, but next year, it won't be till 2024, the book will be coming out. But the chapters are already available, and we are very keen to get feedback on people going, well, why aren't you talking about this, and how do we do this? And the whole point is to generate some some questions. And the book, I would say, is quite controversial, given what people ask us at conferences about, oh, shall we just rewrite everything in C or Rust? The fact that we're saying, no, don't do that, is not what people are expecting to see. It is controversial. And the fact that we're saying, you know, this is a buy, not build, is not what people necessarily want to read in an O'Reilly book. So there will be controversy about this, but that's good. That's what we want. That's what we want.
Excellent. And we'll talk more about this in future. Anne Curry, thank you so much. I've really enjoyed this, and I hope the audience has too. Thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
Sustainability is no longer a nice to have. It's a priority. Vertiv Power, cooling and IT management solutions for critical infrastructure, are designed to reduce the use of energy, water, and space. From innovative liquid cooling to dynamic grid services, we work hand-in-hand with customers to enable them to meet their data center sustainability goals. Visit us at vertiv.com and see what we can do for you.
Thanks for listening to the Zero Downtime Podcast. Brought to you in partnership with Vertiv, the world's leading critical digital infrastructure provider. Don't forget to like this podcast and subscribe to our channel. We'll see you again next time.